Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And today on the program, we are recapping 2015, the highs, the lows, plus discussing your dream headlines and the winner of the Tribune's annual Utahn of the Year Award. And joining me this morning in studio, Tribune editor and publisher Terry Orme is with us. Terry, good morning.
Good morning and happy holidays to
happy
everybody.
Happy holidays. Deputy editor and editorial editor Tim Fitzpatrick is with us. Tim, good morning to you.
Good morning, all.
And managing editor Dave Noyes is with us. Dave, good morning to you.
Hi.
Hi. People, all at the end of the year, we compile lists. And every year, journalists look back on the significant news stories. As you've been thinking what should be on the Tribune's list, what are the general criteria that you use? How to sort of determine what rises to the level of top stories? Dave Noyes?
Well, I begin by reviewing the front page and the Utah section front for every day for the last year, for 2015. That takes a couple of weeks to go through all those, reasoning that any story that's a top story at some point is probably going to appear on one of those front pages. Send that list around to other editors, get their input, listen to colleagues, and kind of start from there.
And Terry, I mean, do you have some input on this list compilation?
Oh, I have a little input. Dave listens to me a little bit, you know, in writing this. I look for impact, you know, stories that have legs, stories that will resonate with people, will affect policy and how government operates, and stories that will still be with us in 2016, stories that are not one-day wonders. You know, we call those some stories one-day wonders that are with us for a day and gone the next. Those wouldn't be on the list. It would be the stories that get people talking and get people perhaps calling for action.
And Tim, in the digital age, of course, we're all looking at analytics. The top stories of the year, not necessarily the most popular stories online.
Absolutely. That kind of goes back to that one-day wonder sort of thing. We see certain stories that are not very consequential, but still will shoot right up for, you know, usually some sordid reason, frankly, or something else. But they don't really have last ability. They don't make that list because it really is about things that, from my perspective, I review a lot of letters, a lot of op-eds. And that's where you kind of get this feeling about what people truly care about, where you get a lot of feedback. It's the bigger issues.
Mm-hmm. Staying power is crucial to this list. And this is an issue that lingered from last year. It seemed to take the nation by storm. 2015 started off with a few officer-involved shootings, which really brought the national debate over police use of force to Utah, Dave. Remind people, I mean, we started off in January pretty dramatically.
Yeah, we did. As a matter of fact, end of 2014 quite dramatically also. The first three homicides of 2015 and the last one of 2014 were all officer-involved shootings. So that's a pretty stark reminder right there. In 2014, there were 14 officer-involved shooting that turned into fatalities. A few fewer this year, down to 9 so far, at least as of this taping. So that's kind of where we stand.
And we have heard less of this recently, but it's certainly not a resolved issue. Terry Orme?
No, and it's also Utah's piece of a bigger puzzle, of the national puzzle. You know, this has been the issue, one of the big issues of the year nationally. You know, shootings in Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore, and Chicago, on and on and on. This is just a very big issue, and Utah was right there with those four homicides right in a row. Those first three all happened within the same week. It was all of a sudden we're saying to ourselves, boy, we have this problem just like those really big, and we like perhaps think more violent places are having, and it was an eye opener.
Mm-hmm. The year's major cultural shift, I would argue, LGBT rights and the legalization of gay marriage, that was also years in the making, but it happened officially in June of 2015. Even before that, though, various institutions, social conventions, the law saw it coming, Tim Fitzpatrick. Early in the year, we saw the state legislature grapple with the issue of equality.
It is sort of the, I guess you'd call it the civil rights movement of our time. And it hasn't played out yet. It is a very challenging issue for a lot of people, but it's also we are reaching a point for a group of people that had to live in the shadows for a long, long time, and they didn't deserve that. And so this is it's a good thing. It's a painful process, but it's very much worthwhile.
In the spring, the Utah State Legislature passed non-discrimination legislation that protects gays and lesbians in employment and housing. Terry Orme, this was a big deal.
Yes, it was. And again, I'm going to kind of repeat myself here. It also put us front and center in a very big national issue. Resolving gay rights and non-discrimination with religious rights. The legislature in March pulled that off and really got some attention. And then, of course, later that year, we elect the first openly gay mayor of Salt Lake City. And again, put us front and center in on the issue nationally. So Utah was really in the spotlight on that.
Dave, the LDS Church got unusually involved in this legislation.
Yeah, it was fascinating to watch, actually. Senator Urquhart from down in St. George had been trying for several years to get a non-discrimination ordinance, or statute, I should say, passed through the legislature. Went nowhere, absolutely nowhere, rarely got a hearing. Suddenly, LDS Church trotted out some apostles and a women's leader, a high-profile women's leader, and essentially called on the state to pass a non-discrimination ordinance, one that would protect the housing and employment rights of the LGBT community while, as Terry said, balancing some religious freedoms. It was amazing how the effect that had on the legislature. Suddenly, it was getting hearings, passing overwhelmingly. A bill was crafted and endorsed by the LDS Church and passed quite resoundingly and was quickly signed into law by Governor Herbert.
This was also the year that the Boy Scouts of America decided to allow gay scout masters. And again, Terry, a national story yeah. comes right home. The LDS Church, the scouting's biggest supporter, wavered a little bit, but ultimately decided to stay with the Boy Scouts. What strikes you about this decision?
Well,
to stay?
One thing. Scouting is so big in Utah. I mean, scouting is bigger nowhere else than in Utah, and you know it was really on the bubble of what the LDS Church was going to do. Were they going to break off and take their scouts into another program or stay in the Boy Scouts fold? It was a question right up until they made the decision. And again, scouting is so important in the fabric of life in Utah that it's just a very big issue and a big decision on the LDS Church's part.
Mm-hmm. And Tim, as Terry mentioned, all of this leading up to Jackie Biskupski's election as the next mayor of Salt Lake City in November. The Tribune editorial board, of course, endorsed Biskupski. What did you see in her that would serve the capital city well?
You know, much of it had to do with Becker fatigue. I don't want to understate Jackie's abilities and what she'll be able to do, but much of the election was a reaction to it's very hard for anybody to get 12 years. We saw pockets all over the city of people who had decided they'd had enough of Ralph Becker, someone who has done many great things for the city, but still sort of was hitting a point. So I, in terms of Jackie, I think what Jackie is bringing is a set of skills that are more sort of hands-on. Ralph Becker wanted to fly at 30,000 feet and delegate everything, and we saw problems with Chris Burbank. We saw problems elsewhere that came essentially from not being on the ground and managing enough. I think that what Jackie is telling people is she will do that. I think interesting, you know, more important, frankly, than being gay is what she pledges to do with regard to making the city more diverse. And I think that we have to recognize that the city is about 30% Latino, and they're not very visible in city government. We need more in leadership positions. We need more cops on the street. We need more. There needs to be more recognition of that. She has made that. She got the support of many in the Latino community. She has to act on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Terry.
I just want to add that the gay rights piece of that or issue was not a strike against Becker. Becker was very gay rights friendly and did a lot for gay rights, and was very progressive in that regard. So that really in our decision that really wasn't a factor.
In fact, the gay community was quite split in that race.
Mm-hmm. And yet she's emerged as the face of this LGBT surge for civil rights. Dave?
Yeah. I don't think that it's obviously nationally, it's a big story. The mayor of Salt Lake City, Utah, is openly gay. Utahns understand that dynamic. They understand that Salt Lake City is sort of this blue oasis in this, you know, red sea, and that it's quite liberal, a very gay friendly city. Has been recognized as such, and Mayor Buskupski kind of epitomizes and is sort of the symbol of that now.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in Salt Lake City, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Joining me in studio, Terry Orme, Tim Fitzpatrick, and Dave Noyce of the Salt Lake Tribune. Again, we are talking about the top stories of 2015 here in Utah. And one of the really big stories this year was the decision not to expand Medicaid. And Dave, can you remind our listeners what happened, or more appropriately, what didn't happen?
Yeah, it's been a torturous path that is still not anywhere near the end. For several years now, Utah legislature has been grappling with how to fund an alternative to Medicaid expansion. They've tried, Governor Gary Herbert floated his plan, which was seemed quite robust and was backed by many health professionals.
And the federal government signed on.
And the federal government signed on, which was a thing he had to negotiate. It went nowhere in the legislature. Jim Dunnigan floated a plan called Utah Cares. A lot of advocates called it Utah Cares Less because it had such bare bones coverage that it went nowhere also. Finally, the Gang of Six, a group called the Gang of Six, which included, Spencer Cox, the legislative leaders, Greg Hughes, Wayne Niederhauser, Brian Shiozawa, a primary force on healthcare on the Hill, got together and crafted a plan called Utah Access Plus, I believe is what it was called. You would think, having that kind of firepower behind it, that it could get through the legislature and get enough votes to pass. But it was defeated. And it was defeated in secret votes at the legislature in the House and the Senate, something that angered a lot of people. So still nowhere, no resolution in sight, and tens of thousands of Utahns are still going without health care coverage and testifying on Capitol Hill about people who have been dying because of it.
The secret part of this, Terry, is spurring Utah journalists to action. Tell us a little bit about those efforts.
Yeah, the Utah Media Coalition, which is a group of news media, newspapers, television stations, et cetera, have written a letter to legislative leadership saying that in these secret caucuses where they made the decision about Utah Access Plus to not even allow a vote on it, those meetings are illegal, that they are against the spirit and the letter of the Utah Constitution. And so hopefully that letter will be taken seriously and they will reconsider this technique of legislating in the upcoming session. But what happened with Utah Access Plus was the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. This sort of thing has gone on for years, but this is such an important policy question, and to have it debated and decided in secret without legislators' constituents knowing what was said, what the positions of their lawmakers are, really just goes against the concepts of good government.
Are journalists prepared to take this to court?
Not at this time. The Media Coalition hasn't discussed legal action, hasn't discussed a lawsuit. I wouldn't say it's impossible, but that bridge hasn't been crossed yet in discussions. You know, one thing about this issue, you talk to people like Ben McAdams, you talk to Jackie Paskupski and Ralph Becker, you talk to Gail Miller and Palmer DePaulis, who've done a lot of work on homeless issues. Medicaid expansion is one of the keys, they say, to making improvements with our homeless situation. And so this has far-reaching ramifications. It really gets into areas you might not think it does, with drug addiction and dealing with those sorts of problems. So, again, this is something that will be talked about in 2016.
Let's transition to homelessness, which also was a huge issue in 2015. And Tim, tell us, remind our listeners a little bit about the discussion. What was at stake? Who was involved in crafting a plan to go forward and combat homelessness?
I think it kind of sneaked up on people this year that it's never gone away, but there was a bit of an explosion in the population. There was, interestingly enough, there was some publicity over the fact that Utah had successfully dealt with a 10% of the population, which they called the chronically homeless. They basically went to a housing first solution, and it was it generated some publicity elsewhere. There's some questions whether that actually drew homeless people here. Most people are not in that chronically homeless situation. They're more short term. So the solutions are getting a little bit more creative now in terms of trying to figure out how to catch them before they ever end up downtown near the shelters. And you know, so the solutions are getting better. But really, I think that it took some agitation on the part of the people who live and work around there to kind of bring this to a head. The drug issue down there it definitely got away. The cops acknowledged that, and they're trying to get ahead of it too now. So,
and very recently, we had Salt Lake County present a plan. Salt Lake City presented a plan, and these are seen as groundbreaking measures, Dave.
Yeah, it's they're looking at scattering homeless services around certainly the city and they would hope the valley, seeing this is certainly not just a Salt Lake City problem that will take a community-wide, valley-wide, if not statewide, solution. And the aim is to separate some of the subgroups of the homeless so that you're not clumping them all together. The subgroups like families and women and victims of domestic abuse, they have different needs than some of the other homeless individuals. So that's the plan, is to scatter those around. Interestingly enough, though, the locals are going to have to go with their hand out to the legislature to get some funding to help do that. $20 million they're looking for, along with $7 million in annual appropriations to help them pull off that.
So, again, another story bleeding into the new year. Let's talk about the national controversy over Planned Parenthood funding, which also spilled over into Utah when Governor Gary Herbert decided to halt those federal funds that passed through the health department to Planned Parenthood. At that point, the nonprofit took action of their own, Terry, and that was a little groundbreaking in its own right.
Yeah, they basically asked for a restraining order to keep the funds flowing, and basically said that the governor's actions were unconstitutional, violated their rights of free speech, and et cetera, et cetera. And the governor also got some pushback within his own administration. Some of the state health officials said that this was a bad policy. This would hurt people who need these services, and they were against it. But just this week, a federal judge who issued the restraining order basically said, "No, the governor was within his purview to stop those funds, so he can do that." Where it goes from here, Kerry Galloway says, who's the CEO of Planned Parenthood in Utah, is saying that they'll weigh their legal options and see. The governor is being, so far, really not showing his cards because the funds still continue through this year, and he hasn't said definitively that he's going to cut off these funds. So we'll see.
Tim, do you have a prediction? Well, I mean, if not Planned Parenthood, who is going to provide the STD education, the sex ed programs that Planned Parenthood provides through these funds?
That is the ultimately the big question, because the services are definitely needed. It's you do see a pledge from Planned Parenthood to keep doing what they're doing and find the money wherever they can. There is something of a pledge from the governor, who frankly acted fairly. It seems political because of the timing. He did this like 2 days before the Republican convention. He's facing an opponent on the right. He was trying to, you know, bolster his credentials in that crowd. And it almost seems like he's not sure. I'm not sure he would do that decision again, knowing what he knows now. And that's why you're seeing he's sort of a little bit more noncommittal at this point. So is it possible state funding would go on with Planned Parenthood? Yeah, but I think more likely is that Planned Parenthood will go on without the state and some combination of other providers who, you know, the governor does approve of or allow or whatever will be able to, or hopefully be able to, fill in.
While we're on the subject of politics, let's move on to the controversial idea of moving the state prison out of Draper. We had hearings. We had protests. In the end, lawmakers agreed to make the move to Salt Lake City. And Dave Noyce, this was months and months of wrangling.
Yeah, if not years, actually. I think Governor John Huntsman first floated the idea and came back and decided it wasn't the time and it was cost too much to do. And it suddenly started gaining real traction in the last several years, to the point that the legislature, it it seemed destined that they were going to approve of, they'd already decided they were going to move the prison. It was a choice of where it would go. There were four finalists, Prison Relocation Commission with some consultants outside help, had four finalists, two in Utah County, Eagle Mountain, and Saratoga Springs, I believe. No, Fairfield. And then also Grantsville, and then the Salt Lake City site west of the International Airport. No one wanted it. It's unusual. As a matter of fact, I was reading, I'm struck by a $550 million project and no one wanted it. It seems that's rare in development terms.
Although, wasn't the opposition in Tooele sort of lukewarm? I think their officials were the most amenable to it.
Officials, yes. Grassroots not so much so. And that's who was packing the meetings, yeah. And that was kind of interesting. It's not unusual, actually, when something like a corrections facility is going to be located, whether it's a halfway house or a full-scale prison, that will get the troops out who don't normally go to meetings to go. Salt Lake City was selected. Consultants seemed to agree, and I think a lot of people agreed that it was probably the logical place. Salt Lake City also was seen as not having the political clout to stop it. It may be the capital city, but it's represented by Democrats, and Democrats don't have a lot of sway on a Republican-dominated Capitol Hill.
Terry, what strikes you about the prison move?
Well, you know, the Tribune's editorial board actually weighed in on this, and we saw some logic to moving it to Salt Lake City. A prison needs to be near the courts, obviously, needs to be near medical facilities, needs to be near the families of the prisoners, and needs to be near an employment and volunteer population base. And so we thought there was it made some sense to move it to Salt Lake City. Part of the prison move, what they're promising, what prison officials and legislators and the governor are promising, is this is all a piece of prison reform. This is a way to really rehabilitate these people with a new facility which is built for that. Hopefully it'll reduce recidivism. Hopefully the prison population will be smaller. So those reasons were part of the move to Salt Lake City, part of the reasons given for moving it to Salt Lake City. Mm-hmm. The big question is, it's on the shores of the Great Salt Lake, and it's there are some issues out there with building and whether it's a really a suitable site.
And Terry mentioned criminal justice reform, which it was another big issue this year, and Tim, the emphasis on prevention, a long time coming.
It is a long time coming, and really, honestly, it keys back to, once again, Medicaid. If judicial reform in its present form is to fly, the biggest, most important need right now is going to be treatment money. And honestly, doing this without Medicaid is almost impossible. So I don't think we're done with Medicaid by any stretch. I think the prison move itself was, the thing you have to remember about the prison move is that moving the prison wasn't decided this year. It was decided long ago. They named the commission the Prison Location Commission. It was never about leaving it in Draper, and I think you can make a decent argument for that's not highest and best use of the land in Draper. But I think that the process still came off as a sham. And I think that's why there's a lot of bitterness about it. And it's true, nobody really wanted a prison, and including Salt Lake. Although I think actually it makes a lot of sense where it is if you can solve the fact that it may be a swamp.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, and we're talking about the top stories of 2015. There's usually a natural disaster on a top stories of the year list. This year, no different. We had flash flooding rip through southern Utah, killing 21 people. And these were twin tragedies to hit both Zion National Park and the polygamous town of Hilldale. It's pretty awful down there, Dave.
Yeah, the Hilldale flash flood claimed 13 people, three mothers, 10 children. One six-year-old boy's remains have still not been located. It was interesting to see what happened in the wake of that flood. It's a very divided community, and some between, you know, ex-polygamists and polygamists, ex-members of the FLDS Church and those that are still faithful to the FLDS Church. It was one of those moments that united that community in the search. You saw them kind of hand in hand out searching for bodies, and also had an interesting memorial service where the governor was there and the community got together and mourned and grieved over their loss. And it was an interesting moment in time. It's a place that you only hear about usually in regards to Warren Jeffs and United Effort Plan and foreclosures and people getting booted out of the church. But this was a moment of shared humanity.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a history of tension between government and the religion down in Hilldale. Do you think the cooperation, Terry, that came from fighting the floods, searching and rescuing people, I mean, is that going to linger?
You know, I hate to predict that. I don't think it will. I think that the rifts are too deep and too historic to really be smoothed over by this one event. Some of the small individual stories down there, some of the moments that were captured by some really good reporting by our Nate Carlisle. One moment is the mayor of Hilldale walks out of a meeting and he is approached by one of the residents there who goes and kind of puts his hand on the mayor's shoulder. And this mayor just ignores him because there's a long dispute between the two. And, you know, it's just those moments were so telling that the divisions are deep within the community and certainly between the community and government officials.
Well, speaking of that sort of tension, the public lands debate continued to simmer this year. And in May, San Juan County Commissioner Phil Lyman was convicted of riding ATVs through a closed portion of Recapture Canyon. Very recently, he was sentenced to serve 10 days in jail, 3 years probation. Tim, how is the Lyman case going to affect the public lands debate going forward?
Well, I think, you know, the interesting thing about Phil Lyman is that I think he got caught up in the Clive and Bundy movement, that he didn't really, it got away from him, frankly. The timing was such that the whole Clive and Bundy fight over grazing rights, and this is the guy in Nevada who...
he had an armed standoff.
Yeah, and it drew a lot of crazies, frankly, and it was a very, those crazies needed someplace to go next, and a lot of them went and joined this ride, and Phil Lyman had a crowd with him for his protest that went beyond his protest, but he still, I mean, you know, the conviction was that he incited them, and the facts would seem to indicate that, too. I think he wanted to make a statement. I don't think he necessarily wanted to make the statement that was made. The effect on the public lands debate, frankly, is probably not that big, although I will say that San Juan County is ground zero for public lands in 2016. We're going to see if Rob Bishop and Jason Chaffetz can't find a legislative solution, and I believe they're earnestly trying. I'm not sure that they really will go far enough for a true compromise. But if they don't, I think the possibility of a national monument in the Bears Ears area is very prominent.
Mm-hmm. So we have all these different threads. We've got the Lyman case. We've got the national monument prospect. Now we have a legislative committee endorsing a lawsuit against the federal government over public lands and a willingness to spend $14 million to do it. I mean, this debate certainly is not over. Dave Noyce.
Yeah. Matter of fact, you could say it might be just getting started in that sense. they based the committee based its decision on a legal analysis that some say is rather shaky, that Utah has some prospects of actually prevailing in and taking control of 31 million acres in the state. It's debatable whether they could prevail, and it's debatable if they did prevail that they could actually govern the lands any more effectively, if not less effectively. But that's going to continue to play out. And I think the Phil Lyman case will have legs in that sense, and he's sort of become a poster child, I guess, for that camp. Sort of the anti-federal camp that's trying to lead that movement.
And Terry, so is the bill, the congressional bill that Tim mentioned, that's being developed and pushed by Representatives Bishop and Chaffetz, is that going to happen? Could that possibly solve all of these issues?
Well, the fact that we haven't seen it yet, I think, is an indication of how difficult what they're trying to do really is. I mean, to their credit, they're trying to get a lot of people to the table and a lot of diverse points of view to the table. The oil and gas industry, the environmentalists, the recreationalists, the county commissioners. One group they seem to be struggling with is to get the Native American tribes to their table, and that's important. I think that's a group that Barack Obama, the president, in perhaps declaring a monument, that he will listen to those people. So it's a big tall order. They've got about a year, well, less than a year to get it done, and they say they're working very hard. And like Tim, I believe them. But it's a long, tough road.
One more thing I'd just like to say with regard to federal land transfer. The economics of it do not work in Utah's favor. And the biggest factor right now in that is that oil is around $40 a barrel. The study that was done by Utah State University and the University of Utah basically indicated that this thing only pencils if you're at least $62 a barrel. And that was an optimistic number in the sense that it's very hard to predict things like fires. Huge amount of money, federal money, gets spent on fires. If we had to cover that ourselves, we could have something that would just be an absolute budget buster. So the economics of federal land transfer, regardless of what the legal analysis or legislative solution might be, it doesn't look good for us right now. We would be very foolish to do it.
Before we head to a break, we have to talk about the LDS Church, because the headlines just kept coming this year. And so many of the stories that came from the Salt Lake Tribune and out of the church turned into national stories. We had the story about church founder Joseph Smith Searstone that he purportedly used to translate the Book of Mormon. We had three new apostles appointed. Most recently, the church found itself in the middle of a firestorm about a policy concerning gay couples and their families. I mean, Dave Noyce, you've reported on the LDS Church for a long time. How significant is 2015 in Mormon history?
In some respects, it might be more significant than the Mormon moment. Several years ago when Mitt Romney was running, actually, because I think there are policies and positions that were taken that have much more effect, frankly, within the faith and within the culture. The Searstone was an oddity, I guess, sort of a fun little thing to look at, this little kind of polished brown rock.
But it was a signal of the church's new sense of transparency.
Transparency, the essays that they've been posting, where they've been tackling some of the thornier theological and historical topics in the church. The three apostles, the deaths of Boyd K. Packer, L. Tom Perry, and Richard G. Scott, longtime senior apostles, provided an opening for the LDS Church to sort of diversify its top ranks. A lot of people were looking to see if that would happen, and it really didn't. Three white males were chosen, Ronald Rasband, Gary Stevenson, Gary Renland, Ronald Rasband, and they were chosen to fill those slots. Some more diverse leadership positions to fill the ranks where they came from, sort of evidence themselves, including Garrett Gong, who was selected for one of the presidency of the 70. So you had that happen, and Dallin Oaks gave a landmark speech about gay rights, in which he called for a middle path that balances religious freedom and rights for the LGBT community.
And then
a month later, the LDS Church unveiled a policy, was sort of leaked out, and then they had to announce it, a new policy on same-sex couples. Same-sex married Mormons were deemed apostates under this, worthy of possible excommunication, requiring essentially local leaders to take disciplinary action, not mandating what the outcome of that action should be. Perhaps the part that kind of generated the most buzz was the policy that treats the children of those same-sex couples, forbids them from entering religious rites in the church. They can't be baptized. They can't receive what's called a naming blessing. They can't go on missions. They can't unless they get approval. And they can't do any of these things generally until they're 18 years old. And that shook, a lot of the people outside the faith and in the LGBT community, but within the faith, including bishops and stake presidents and faithful, devout Mormons.
From time to time, Terry, the Tribune is asked the question, why do we cover the Mormon Church so intensely? What's your answer?
Well, because they make news. We're in the headquarters of the LDS Church. It's one of the things we do best, quite frankly, is our position to do best. Every year, if you were talking the top stories of the year, I think an LDS Church role in those stories is going to be prominent. This year, though, I think tops them all, with same-sex marriage front and center, and the whole ordained women movement front and center. One thing that strikes me is how willing faithful LDS members have become to voice their opinions on what their leaders do. And I would attribute that really to the pervasiveness of social media and blogs and et cetera, et cetera. It seems like the conversation is a lot more robust and a lot more out there, so to speak. And that certainly was the case in 2015.
I agree. Yeah. I think really what we're seeing is the diversity of the Mormon Church, of the Mormon population. It is not a monolith, and that is creating tension. Frankly, the leadership has been a little slow to recognize that, as Dave mentioned. When they had an opportunity to appoint apostles, they went with two Aggies and a Ute. Is that right? and I think that it's a worldwide religion. There are more people outside the country than inside the country in the church. And I think there has to be a little bit more recognition of that coming from them. So I think they're getting their membership. And yes, the internet, that drives the Seer Stone story. That drives a lot of things, is that people are Googling Joseph Smith and being surprised. And so I think there is much more. I don't think there's a crisis of faith, frankly. I think it's Mormons of all diversity want to be Mormons, but they also see that they want it to be something different. They want to have a role in shaping it, and I think you're seeing a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. Speaking about Utah News 2015 with Tim Fitzpatrick, Terry Orme, and Dave Noyce, we have got to take another break. We'll be right back. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW Salt Lake City throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune, and time to talk about the Tribune's annual Utahn of the Year Award. Before we get to the winner, why does the paper do this, and what does the award represent? Terry?
Well, we do it to get people talking, and it's also just another lens to use to look at the year. The criteria is really, we try to find the person who had the biggest impact during the previous 12 months. You know, in the past, we've been doing this since 1997. Our first one, by the way, was Karl Malone. The first year he was named MVP in the NBA, and the first year he led the team to the NBA Finals. Sometimes they've been sort of life achievement awards, you know, people who have had an impact over the years, and sometimes it's been people who really kind of helped define the year or in many ways defined the year.
So here we are. Traditionally, the honoree is named on Christmas Day. Who is the Utahn of the Year for 2015?
Okay, I'm not going to tell you. You have to go buy a newspaper. We have chosen House Speaker Greg Hughes as our Utahn of the Year. The reason for that, if you listen to the last several minutes of our conversation and what we've been talking about, his hand has been in the biggest stories of the year, certainly in the failure of Medicaid expansion. Certainly, he was the one a few years ago who first introduced the bill that would start the process for moving the prison. The prison is currently in his Draper district. He was a big mover and shaker as House Speaker with that process, of course. He also has been prominent in UTA, Utah Transit Authority, very troubled, controversial agency. He has been part of that controversy and continued to be part of that controversy in 2015, even though he's no longer chairman of the board. He has just played a big, big role the policy issues of the year, including homeless, which I'll ask Dave to talk about that.
Okay, Dave, you're on.
Paul Raleigh actually wrote several columns about Greg Hughes, talking of going down and seeing what the homeless situation was like, and saying that he felt like the state needed to do something, and the onus is going to be on them now to see, because the locals are coming at them with hat in hand, trying to get some money to help do some things there.
Mm-hmm. Well, undoubtedly, some are going to be surprised by this selection. It is a bit of a departure from the Lifetime Achievement Awards that the Tribune has given in the past, and particularly because Speaker Hughes is not universally loved. But again, Tim, this is not what this award is about, right?
That's right. it is, more so than any previous person who has we have chosen for this. He is probably viewed the least positively. I can tell you that in past discussions on this, we've talked about John Swallow. I can't remember who else. We've had discussions before about, and of course, you know, Greg Hughes is no John Swallow. I don't want to imply that, but it's still, we haven't really gone this way. I think that what sort of pushed us over the top this time was how connected he was to so many stories. It does, and really, frankly, you know, one of the big things about this, the Swiss trip says a lot about Greg Hughes and his style. He's a power player, and he doesn't really care necessarily that much for public processes. He wants to tie a bow around it and then show it to us, you know, once it's all done. It's not how the public wants it to work, and that's been a lot of his a lot of the pushback. But he is in a position of power, and he is dictating. And if he, you know, he was sort of circumspect about Medicaid and whether he really even wanted it. But what he did definitely didn't produce it, and he knew that. frankly.
Okay, Salt Lake Tribune, Utah of the Year for 2015, House Speaker Greg Hughes. And Terry, I imagine you'll be getting a few phone calls on that one.
I imagine.
Terry Orme, Tim Fitzpatrick, Dave Noyce of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, everybody, for your time, and happy holidays.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks. Thank you.
We'll wrap up this week with Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, he talks about Christmas with the grandkids.
With your own children, you work so hard at trying to make Christmas perfect, to find out what they want, when they actually want it, because it changes as Christmas gets closer.
Sure.
And you have to abide by tradition. Kids will make you stick to tradition because they want Christmas to be, you know, what they've always remembered. But with grandkids, when they come along, I mean, you can handle it on your own terms for the most part. You just give them what they want, and they're giddy as they can be about it. And so you can actually sit back because their parents are doing all the work to make it perfect, and you just show up with presents. And it's kind of like being Santa Claus without the sleigh.
Well, in 2007, you wrote about a Christmas where it was not at your house, where the chaos...
The first one, yeah.
Where the chaos occurred at your daughter's house. I'd love you to read the beginning of this column. It's so great.
I told my grandkids not to call Christmas morning before 7 a.m. unless they could actually see reindeer poop on their roof. The call came at 7:01 a.m. "There's no poop," 6-year-old Hallie said, "but we want to open presents anyway." My wife and I dragged ourselves out of bed and drove half a mile to watch our grandkids open their Christmas gifts. For the first time in 32 years of marriage, they would not be opened at our house. Over at my daughter's place, hallowed family tradition was still observed for about 30 seconds. When greed finally overcame decorum, the kids rushed the tree. It was like fast-forwarding the sack of Rome.
That's such a great visual, and it's so true.
Yes, it is. If you look back at the Christmases that you had when you were a kid, you can almost, I mean, they're so indelible, you can almost feel it, like a drug entering your bloodstream, how thrilled you were, because the windup is so long. And then to watch your kids and then your grandkids go through it, it's really special.
What is it about Christmas that just makes it so intense and pleasurable?
I don't know. You know, you look at other cultures and you, like Jews and Muslims, and you wonder, how can they possibly get along without Christmas? And then you realize that they have their own celebrations. But for Christmas, maybe it's an end of the year thing where it marks the passing, another milestone, and you're just happy that you got through it and you were good enough to get presents, even though you probably weren't.
Does Christmas remain special for you as an adult?
Yeah, it does. You know, you make that transition away from not caring, you know, what you get for Christmas to not caring if you even get anything. As long as you can, I mean, you realize if you're surrounded by people who love you and you're not in agonizing pain, that's the best gift of all.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can read all the Kirby archives at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW, UPR, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams and Bennett Purser at UPR, and Emily Means from the Tribune. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening, and happy holidays.